Let's call the meeting of the Energy Policy and Finance Division to order. Quorum is present. First, we'll take the roll, and first order of business is the approval of minutes from March 5th. Representative Brainerd, have you had a chance to peruse the minutes?
I have perused them, Chair Hilton.
Would you care to make a motion for their approval?
Yes, I move the approval of the minutes. I perused them, but I don't remember their dates, so.
March 5th.
Of March, for March 5th.
Are there any additions or corrections? Yes, actually, Mr. Pomeroy has pointed out that there does need to be a correction, which is the time of recess, which is not 4:58, but really 3:58. We anticipated daylight savings time a couple of days early, apparently. Are there other corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Minutes are adopted. Members, Representative Saylor's witness is not yet available, and what we're going to do on the agenda is move to House File 3401 first.
Representative Hilke, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, I would. Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 3401 for consideration by the committee. Madam Chair and members, this is the bill that we discussed and had testimony on. I think, I don't remember which meeting, a couple of weeks ago, and I think we pretty much went through the bill in its entirety. One of the reasons that we laid it over was for a possible inclusion in an omnibus bill, and then we're not precluding that possibility, but another reason is that Mr. Eloff, in reading the bill, discovered some basically technical amendments that needed to be made. And we have before us today the H3401DE4 amendment, which accomplishes that. And Madam Chair, if we could ask Mr. Eloff to explain to the committee what changes were made, I think that would expedite things.
Does everyone have that amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I brought a list of the changes, or I thought I brought a list of the changes down with me, but I think I can do this on the fly with a fairly short bill. I know there were no changes made to the first page. That's easy. On page 2, on line 2-6, the word incorporate was inserted. I think I replaced based on. It was just more clear that the commissioners are to incorporate the performance standards that are developed in later sections of the bill. In subdivision 9 on page 2, on line 226, the word residential was inserted, and instead of commercial hyphen industrial, we have both commercial and industrial buildings and institutional buildings that these performance standards are to apply to. At the top of page 3, lines 3.4 to 3.8 were added. In line 3.2, you'll notice that there's a Sustainable Building 2030 implementation plan that the Commissioner of Commerce and the Center for Sustainable Building Research are supposed to put together. This just lists some of the elements that are supposed to be in that plan. And lines 3.9 and 3.10 state that the plan must be submitted to the legislature by July 1st, 2009. On lines, well, between 3.11 and 3.24, that's paragraph C, carbon dioxide emissions per square foot were inserted as the relevant measure there. I believe the earlier phrase was carbon intensity, which was undefined, so this makes it a lot more clear what we'll be measuring. And on lines 319, 320, it's made clear that the reductions specified on lines 3.21 and 3.22 are to be made off a base of 2003 for an average building in each of those sectors. And I think finally on page 4, lines 16 through 19 is language that specifies more clearly that utilities making expenditures under the conservation improvement programs that result in a building meeting these guidelines can claim the energy savings towards its energy savings goal. And on line 421, we added the date of January 15, 2010 as the first time that the commissioner is to report to the legislature on the cost effectiveness and progress of implementing these standards. That's a summary of the changes that were made.
Representative Hilton, would you like to move your amendment?
I would, Madam Chair, move adoption of the DE4 amendment. And Mr. Pomeroy has pointed out, I believe there's one more change in the amendment, which I would incorporate, and that is on line 8, page 1, line 18. Delete the word complete.
Do you remember see that? Do you incorporate that into your amendment?
Yes, I'm sure.
Any discussion? All those in favor of adopting the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. Representative Hilty, to your bill.
Madam Chair, as I said earlier, I think we did have a fairly thorough discussion of the bill. I don't believe that the amendment that we just adopted changes the bill in any substantial way, and if there is no further discussion to the bill, I would move, Madam Chair, that House File 3401 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register.
I believe it's returned to the Committee on Finance.
Oh, I'm sorry. I wasn't thinking this one came through Finance. Very well, then be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance.
Any discussion to the bill? Seeing none, Representative Hilty renews his motion that House File 3401, as amended, be recommended to pass and be returned to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. The bill is passed. Thank you, Representative Hilty. Do you have another bill up that you'd like to move? Or are we going to...
I believe that Representative Saylor is not quite ready to present his bill, Madam Chair. In this case, I would be happy to move House File 3729 for consideration. And, Madam Chair, I believe the motion on this would be that it be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Government Operations technology and elections, or whatever that's called.
Members, does everybody have a copy of that bill before them? 3729.
Madam Chair and members, this is a bill that I have discussed with a number of members of the committee previously. What it does is provide for restructuring of the Legislative Electric Energy Task Force. It would, in essence, keep that body intact, but change its title and provide for a somewhat broader scope. The reason that I brought this bill forward is I think that it's becoming more and more clear, members, that all of the energy issues that we deal with in this committee and in our society in general are very much interrelated. The Legislative Electric Energy Task Force, when it was established in the early 90s, and unfortunately the main historian of that is not present at the moment, but Representative Osmond, who has expressed his support for this change, was instrumental in the creation of the task force in the first place. And as I'm sure members are aware, the Legislative Electric Energy Task Force, as the title suggests, was tasked to focus primarily, exclusively, on issues surrounding the generation and distribution of electricity in the state. But, as I said, I believe that we can recognize at this point that energy issues are much more complex. We have renewable energy to deal with in all sorts of ways, and also more general consideration of energy resources, the petroleum, natural gas, coal, uranium, whatever, that have implications beyond simply the generation of electricity. And therefore, I ask the committee to entertain and to approve the idea of basically maintaining the same structure of the Legislative Electric Energy Task Force, but to expand its scope and to change the name to recognize that expansion. I should point out that really the only substantial change other than that would be that in recognition of the broadening scope of the commission, we would also expand the assessment authority that is granted to the task force to the other fuel sources that would be involved in the broader scope. It does not change the amount that can be assessed, so actually it would lower the assessment on the electric utilities, but it does expand that to include in subdivision 9 in paragraph 2, petroleum and liquid petroleum as well. There are some numbers that need to be filled in. There are blank numbers in the bill currently. I did not propose to change the number of members of the commission. So on line 1.11, the number that should be filled in is 6. On line 1.12, the number would be 4. And on line 1.14, again, 6, and on 1.154, which is reflective of the current composition of the task force. And I can, Madam Chair, on page 2 of line 2.31, appropriation, that amount should be $250,000, which is where the appropriation authority stands currently. Madam Chair, I would move to incorporate those numbers into the bill.
Mr. Giloff, would you like to just repeat those so members have to make sure they have them properly?
On page 1, line 11, at the end of that line, insert the number 6. Page 1, line 12, insert number 4. Page 1, line 14, insert number 6. And page 1, line 15, insert the number 4. On page 2, line 31, insert $250,000.
Any discussion for the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. Representative Hilty, did you want to speak more to the bill? I know there were some questions.
Madam Chair, I think the bill is pretty straightforward, and I would just answer questions at this time.
Representative Nornick?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question on page 1. There's a description where it refers to representatives of the second largest political party in the House and in the Senate. I'm just curious why those words are used instead of just minority party. I haven't seen that before. Maybe it's been around, but it seems strange to me, that's all.
Madam Chair, Representative Norris, I think maybe we should ask Mr. Eloff for a justification of the terminology.
Mr. Eloff?
It has been around, Representative Nornis, and I brought it in case there are at some point more than two parties, both of which would be considered minority parties.
Okay. Thanks.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Madam Chair, excuse me. Chair Hilty, just a quick question. The term conservation or efficiency appears only once in the in sort of explicitly in the purview of the new commission, if we adopt this, which I support, and that's just on line 2.21, the energy policy and conservation policy report, I believe, is every 4 years, and I don't at all doubt in your commitment to energy efficiency and conservation. I know that you strongly support it. I just want to confirm that to make explicit, I guess, through this question, your response that the achievement of the statewide energy savings goals that we adopted last year will directly be in something that the commission should review as part of the resource plans and other items that come before it.
Madam Chair, Representative Kalin, I think the three reports that are cited are cited specifically because they are required in statute. I think really the significant line there is on line 23, which refers to any other report or study that the commission deems necessary. We can't really anticipate at this time, in the absence of any discussion of the commission, what those might be, but I think that's really what we're looking forward to.
Further discussion? Representative Hackler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Hilty. I'm sorry, I had a phone call. I had to go out of the room, so I wasn't here for the initial introduction of this bill. And I need to hear more about why we need this another layer of government put in place. I think the commission is working pretty perfectly. I think it's working pretty well the way it is. And we as legislators could make it work better. The co-chairs of this could do much more. I know that Senator Messon and I could have done much more.
And but I don't know why we need another layer of government that's going to be established and put in place and then paid for by the utilities. I don't quite understand that concept.
Representative Helfy?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Hackworth, this isn't another anything. What it's merely changing the scope of an existing body, the Legislative Electric Energy Task Force. We're abolishing the Legislative Electric Energy Task Force in order to basically take the same entity and rename it as the Legislative Energy Commission and broaden its focus so that we consider not just the generation of electricity, but other energy-related issues. And they do seem to be so intertwined that I think that we really need to be looking at energy more broadly than just how do we generate electricity in the state. That's what this does. It doesn't add any additional costs that are not already provided for. It doesn't add any new members. It merely transforms the Legislative Electric Energy Task Force into an energy commission with a somewhat broader scope.
Representative Hackworth.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Helfy. Then on page 2, line 2.33, which one of these, are there more people that we're going to bring into the loop to pay for the Electrical Energy Task Force or the commission, and who are they that are going to be new to who's going to be paying the money to run this?
Madam Chair, Representative Hackworth, I believe that the entities mentioned starting on line 2.33 are already being assessed. What we're adding is what begins on line 1 of page 3, which is bulk terminals, provide petroleum products and LP gas. What the consequence of this would be, and we're doing this simply because they would also be, these energy sources would be included in the purview or the mission of the commission. I felt that it was appropriate that they pay part of the assessment, but since the assessment overall amount remains the same, the effect would be to lower the assessment made on the utilities that's already in place. It doesn't add any cost to distribute it somewhat more broadly in sort of recognition of a somewhat more broad scope of the commission.
Representative
Hackworth. Thanks, Madam Chair. And Representative Hilty, from the membership, maybe you could just go over how that's different from what we currently have.
Representative Hilty.
Madam Chair, Representative Hackworth, the Legislative Electric Energy Task Force currently has 20 members. Majority and minority distribution is not specified in statute, but the numbers that we plugged in here, I think, reflect practice that has been in place ever since the task force was established. Other than that, it does specify a membership that is more there's more specific membership of the committee. I thought that we needed to be sure that it did reflect the broadening scope, so we specifically include agriculture in this ag policy or transportation policy, and the Next Generation Energy Board to reflect our continuing and growing recognition that renewables are a big part of our energy picture in Minnesota. Numbers would not change, Representative Batchelor.
Further discussion? Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify in favor or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Hilke renews his motion that House File 3729, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Government Operations, Reform, Technology, and Elections. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
The motion passes and the bill passes. Thank you, Representative Hilke.
Representative Saylor, are you ready to take up your bill, or we can take Representative Gardner's bill first, if you prefer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I'm ready, or but as I understand it, Representative Gardner has a bill up in another committee, so if he wants to go first, that would be all right as well.
That will be fine. Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 3540, be recommended to pass and refer to or place in the general register.
Very well. Representative Gardner, I believe you have an amendment.
I do.
Do you want to take that up at this time, or do you want to address the bill first?
Actually, I'd like to do the amendment first, if I may, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the A2 amendment, which tweaks and clarifies some things that were brought up in the Environment Committee and with some stakeholders. And put the bill in the shape I'd like it to be in.
Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the adoption of the A2 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Gardner, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The reason this bill is in this committee is because of the section related to energy and the Conservation Improvement Program, which I believe is page 5. Mr. Chair and members, this is actually kind of a big step to introduce this idea, and I sort of would like to get a sense of the committee whether this is a direction we should be going, but just the fact that we're having this discussion is a good step. In your packets, you'll actually see some charts from the Climate Change Advisory Group, which talk about how some of our solid waste management activities, particularly recycling, have positive impacts for reducing our greenhouse gas emissions. And that is the purpose of the section on page 5 in this bill. The parts relating to solid waste, recycling, and composting in the MCAG report fall under AFW 7. And on the this top chart in your handout shows the negligible costs or cost savings per ton. But at the bottom, you can see that on the left-hand side, the AFW 7, the waste management portion of this greenhouse gas reduction potential, the waste management is the third highest potential reducer. And on the flip side of that sheet, the PCA was kind enough to give me some materials they showed elsewhere. Having worked in the field for 10 years before, I could speak to this also, but it takes less energy to manufacture new stuff out of recycled materials. Paper, plastic, aluminum, glass, steel, and the like. For example, an aluminum can made out of recycled materials only uses 5% of the energy required to make a new can from raw bauxite ore. That, along with glass, paper, plastic and other things that has already been pulped, refined, smelted, and the like. So it takes lower temperatures to heat things up to make it into new stuff. My original bill had the suggestion that for verifiable increased tons of recycling collected in the state, that could count as an offset. And that didn't seem to be really the direction that we were going to go. And so I'm suggesting that we include it as a potential SIP expense, because you actually do take electricity or reduce the need for electricity on the grid as a whole. And I did talk to two of the utilities about it. Excel had given me some suggested language so that this is consistent with other SIP proposals, and I appreciate that. But it is kind of a far-out concept when you talk about recycling, saving energy, not a lot of light bulbs go on, as it were, no pun intended. But there are cases where there are infrastructure needs, such as a glass plant or an optical sorter, could take broken glass, call it, sort it by color, and then you'd be able to use it for glass instead of a more energy-intensive use like load aggregate. But, Mr. Chair, this is kind of a complicated bill, and this is kind of a new type of proposal, and I certainly would love to see what kind of comments I get from members of the committee.
Well, members, I think that was an invitation. Are there questions to the author of the bill? Representative Norton.
Yeah, I guess my question would be, in rural Minnesota where I live, you know, how practical this would be. I'm not sure where the recycling centers would be for some of the material that we're talking about. I know in the Twin Cities it might be more convenient. So I could see a lot of traveling being necessary to transport some of this material, again, out in many parts of rural Minnesota. So that would be a problem, I think, especially with wear and tear on the roads and the cost of energy today. So, just something to think about.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Gardner.
Representative Nornis, you're very proud of Otter Tail County. They have one of the highest recycling rates in the state, in fact. And some of the material does go relatively locally. I think some of their paper goes to Becker. Some of the newsprint goes to Moorhead to make egg cartons. The one prohibitive issue has been glass, because of the reasons you mentioned. It's heavy, it's costly to transport, and the revenue you get is fairly small. But when you factor in the fossil fuels used, expended to actually deliver materials and to collect them, all of the projections that you have there from CCA are included in that. So the net positive impact is quite high. But rural recycling always has unique challenges to it because of distance and density. That's true.
Mr. Chair, I guess I was thinking mostly of the building, the demo of a building, that kind of material you're talking about recently.
Oh, I see. Mr. Chair and Representative Nornis, the construction and demolition waste portions of this bill is just for the 7 County Metro, for exactly the reason you mentioned.
Okay.
I could have got 7.
Glad you pointed that out.
And the infrastructure is there to take those basic materials, but I did not extend that statewide for the exact reason that you mentioned. And that's not included in the energy part. That's not included in the energy step that's on page 5.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Gardner, what's the fiscal note on this bill?
Mr. Chair,
in a time of scarce resources, and where are we getting it from?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther, in fact, this doesn't have a fiscal note. The as part of the overall objective of this bill is to increase recycling and composting to roughly 60% for recycling, 15% for composting. That is outside of the energy part of the bill. But after talking with different stakeholders and being concerned about the funds, we're asking the MPCA to report to the legislature next week or next year on just what it would take logistically to collect that amount of material and what the cost would be. So next year we would have an idea of whether there's money there in the solid waste management tax or other sources to be able to do that. And so the local and the state government units have given me that feedback.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe I'll help you out a little bit here. According to our fiscal analysts that we have, we can score a $500,000 for PCA's two and a half FTEs to roughly estimate from the PCA is that the solid waste characterization study will cost 2.5 FTEs plus cost about $500,000. And that's their estimate.
Mr. Chair, Representative Guthrie, I have not actually received that fiscal note, and one reason that it's in fiscal 2010 is so it isn't in the current biennium.
Okay.
I do know that it is in a several hundred dollar range, and that's one reason it's not in this year's budget. So.
Thank you.
Representative Kalin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I have a technical question for either Representative Gardner or for Mr. Elis. It's been a while since I read 216B.241 on my way to sleep. I spent a lot of time with it last year,
yeah, 2 days ago.
Yeah. I'm wondering if, as I remember right, we very rarely discuss the term greenhouse gas emissions in the SIP statute. I'm wondering if Mr. Euless might be able to, if you need to take a moment to review thoroughly. I don't recall using it, that the term that much in the bill that the governor's staff and I worked on last year.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, Mr. Euless, late yesterday talking about this SIP issue. We did, as you see in the amendment on page 2, lines 2.4, and a couple lines after that, we actually delete the words greenhouse gas emissions and insert energy use.
Mr. Chair, that's on that question. That's good enough for me. It sounds like Mr. Elis is going to confirm that.
Yeah, we
discussion.
We removed we did remove references to greenhouse gases in this by way of this amendment.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, sir. Representative Gardner, I think that helped maybe from helped move this provision of the bill a little bit forward. I think as you're looking for some feedback on the appropriateness here, it reminds me of a discussion that Representative Robin Brown and I are having on some waste heat recovery cogeneration opportunities in her district that are neither renewable nor truly conservation improvements. And I think, as you know, the conservation improvement program is very much customer-based and utility-based rather than sort of a statewide sector or statewide all energy sector provision, and I think that you're on the right track here in terms of meeting our carbon reduction goals and the usefulness of recycling and resource. I think Representative Gunther actually might have been referring to dollar resources, but I think energy resources are now dollar resources as well, and so I think that you're on the right track in terms of being the fiscal conservative approach and the energy conservative approach and the greenhouse gas conservation approach all kind of lining up. But as we've shifted from the expenditure requirement under SIP to the energy savings requirement now, I think it may be a little bit of an awkward, maybe not a square peg round hole, but maybe an octagonal peg round hole. And I'm happy to speak a little bit more with you privately to talk about maybe some more creative ways we can find to structure it even a little bit better. But I think the mechanics of lining up the solid waste reduction specifically with cost-effective energy savings is going to be tough to the point where I don't know that it's actually going to meet the cost-effectiveness test as the legislative auditor and our legislation have directed the department to do. I may be wrong, but I'm happy to hear your thoughts on it or to speak with you privately about some other ways that we could do it really effectively.
Sure. Mr. Chair,
Representative Gardner.
And Representative Kalin, when I was talking with one of the utilities about this, they had suggested some language, what we put in the amendment on line 2.11, that we refer to, we were essentially trying to make sure that we weren't going too far afield and as far as what would be required, and that we would have to fit 216B.241. But I guess the broader question is whether this is so far out that maybe we need to reevaluate a whole bunch of other things related to SIP, rather than my pushing one particular version, and I certainly would like to get the sense of the committee on that. The representative Kalin is looking a little confused with my words, and I'm just trying to see if is SIP really the way to do this. I am sort of trying to marry two sectors together here, waste management and utilities, and I don't know if this is the right way to do it or not. And but I also want to say I don't want to be here for an hour discussing it if that's how we have to do it, that we could do it another way.
I think we all feel the same way about it. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gardner, the Section 10 on option to decline delivery of local telephone directories, that'd be very popular in my neighborhood, and I think that's an excellent idea. Have you had any pushback from places that produce these things, and is it done anywhere else? Any other
State Gardner?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, I actually have been in discussions even within the hour with some of the directory publishers, and they actually have a national initiative they're trying to get started in. I haven't had time to craft something, but I actually would suggest something we did with electronic waste, which is to say, if there is a national product stewardship system up, that's a kick out for this, and then we get rid of this and go to the national version. And I certainly will pledge to those stakeholders that I can do something on the floor to straighten that out, and also work with the Senate also on that. The original proposal was to have an opt-in system, so no one would get a directory unless you specifically asked for it. And I didn't really think that that was a good job strategy, so I did not use that. I have an opt-out, so you can, if you really don't want a phone book, you can ask to be on the list and not get one.
Representative Welty.
Thank you, Chair Helpy. Representative Gardner, I think that it's a good idea to start taking a look at construction site and demolition waste. Having worked on a construction site before, I can tell you that there is a tremendous amount of cardboard that leaves construction sites just because you're bringing in new appliances and you've got all of that construction materials delivered within cardboard packaging, or a lot of it is. But there are several questions I have related to Section 7, and that is, first of all, you're talking about recycling or reusing 40% of the waste by weight from a project. And I can easily think of times when the contractor I worked with essentially dumped concrete, stone, brick into a roll-off and it went out. And if you're talking about 40% of the weight, the rest of the material didn't add up to the amount of concrete and brick that we put in that roll-off and went off of the site. And so I'm just wondering, have you talked to the contractors or the builders to look at, is this realistic, and are there things that need to be separated out when you come up with your 40% formula?
Representative
Gardner.
And Representative Welty, actually have talked to the builders and have talked to the construction and demolition recyclers. Everything you just mentioned is highly recyclable in the Twin Cities metro area, and the number isn't actually made up. I did talk with the construction and demolition people who actually take the roll-off box. They actually sort it out there rather than have it all separated. And they said that was an achievable number, and the capacity is there to handle that material, but it's only in the 7 County Metro.
Representative Welty. Well, thank you, Representative Gardner. I know that you're only working on the 7 County Metro area, but I could see in the future that this would possibly be expanded to the rest of the state of Minnesota, and I'm just wondering if you've had any discussions with the waste management in greater Minnesota as to their willingness to work towards achieving this goal.
Mr. Chair, Representative Welty,
Representative Gardner.
In these matters, the population density and volume always play a great role, and so that's why a lot of waste management initiatives have first started in the more densely populated areas like the Twin Cities, and if there's stuff that doesn't work, you jettison part of it. If you find the stuff that does work, then that's what you can work from for greater Minnesota. And I should point out, too, that we're asking contractors to keep a record just in case they couldn't recycle everything. If there's certain asbestos abatement stuff they have to deal with, which takes up a certain amount of weight, or if there's just something in that site which is just so far out that you couldn't put it in the mainstream of recycling.
Mr. Welty?
All right, I'll just make two more points. I'll try to keep it to 2 points on this section. Section 7, as I read it, currently it's a requirement because you use the word must instead of maybe talking about it as being a goal, and I'm just wondering if we wouldn't want to start out with this as being a goal to see if the contractors, the builders, and the waste management can work together to achieve a 40% recycling goal. And besides that, I just have to say I was a very big fan of watching This Old House when I was growing up, and I remember just watching them talk about out on the East Coast the programs that they have where waste is taken to a facility, is separated out, the wood's composted, the steel, you know, and all the other metals are separated out, and almost everything gets recycled. It's a great program, so I know that this could be possible, but I guess my concern right now is whether we want to go with a mandate. And so then my follow-up question to that is, since it's not a goal right now and it's a must, unless I'm reading this incorrectly, what is the penalty if we don't achieve, if the builders and the waste management do not achieve the 40% goal?
Mr. Chair, Representative Welty, because the material is fairly homogenous, that's why I put in a firm rate, rather than the municipal recycling cans, bottles, and paper, which are actually goals, statutory goals. So I do feel that that is a feasible number, and the builders do have the ability to point out why they couldn't meet the goal but not face a penalty for it, and there are no penalties specified in the statute.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Gardner, I'm looking at a lot of must, shalls, and wills in this bill, and I'm trying to get my arms around why it's necessary in the first place. I did hear a comment from over here somewhere just a few moments ago that said, you know, we used to do this just because recycling was the right thing to do. But there seems to be a lot of money attached to some of this stuff, people are doing it just because it makes good business sense. And folks, that's one of the things some of us have been trying to preach all along, that if you let the market work, these things take care of themselves. Yes, we have to set some policy objectives, but I'm here to tell you, in the house we just mostly demolished and rebuilt in Le Sueur, I asked my roll-off guy, because I was pulling out steel and copper and stuff like that, he said, throw it all in there. He said, nothing you put in this dumpster goes to a landfill. We dump it at our site, and they sort it. They crush the bricks and the mortar. They like to, either burn wood either goes to a burner or is recycled for wood chips. Has anybody priced sawdust lately? It's over $100 a ton for sawdust. I'm not kidding. Don't even bother pulling the nails out of the stuff. We take care of it, he said. We have an issue with window glass. It's not necessarily recyclable like pop bottles and things are. That just goes to a landfill. Folks, it's inert. So I don't know why we're necessarily in angst on it, because it's very difficult to take window glass out of old buildings and actually run it through a recycling process. But so I guess what I'm looking at here is a bill that has noble intentions. I mean, I laud your concern here, but as you even hear it, I'm not sure I want it to pass this place until we hear from people in the industry who are actually doing this already. They're actually making wood be recycled. We have an aggregate shortage in the Twin Cities, and I'm noticing here that waste that must be recycled on site cannot be buried on site. And I got to ask you, why? Because there are buildings where we crush stuff on site so we can specifically use it again on site, either in paving, as fill for the basement, for French piping around foundations. Again, I think this is way overdrafted, probably again with the noblest of intents, but I'm here to tell you, folks, you may not trust it, but the marketplace is working. Things like this are already happening. We already have demolition landfills that if we put this into play, we'd probably drive them out of business, because they depend on roll-off dumpsters coming full of everything, and they actually make money sorting out the metal and the wood and the things that are there. And just one other thought, I thought I heard you mention a few moments ago, MPCA's got a study or a report. I think they're going to report to us here shortly. Are we ahead of the game by moving this out of committee and keeping it in the legislative process before we even hear from MPCA on whether or not this is an issue and something that needs legislative direction? I don't know, Mr. Gardner. Again, it's a great talking point, but have you been in the business? Have you been to DEMCON landfill? And has MPCA actually passionate about passing this before they've actually talked to us?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, actually I was the director for the Recycling Association of Minnesota for 9.5 years before coming here, and DEMCON was a member in good standing and actually gave me advice on the bill. And I actually do have one of the facilities that has both a landfill and recycling stuff here who can testify, but Mr. Representative Hilty, I don't know if you how much time you want to take, but part of the reason that the construction waste material isn't here is to create an economy of scale that isn't there with the market. And once that is there, that's when the market really takes off. We've done it with municipal waste recycling, where there were certain requirements put in place, and that has allowed so much material to be collected that manufacturers like paper mills and smelters and so on have actually asked for more material. And yet there's a disconnect between the waste generator and the waste collector. The waste collector would actually like to get more of that material. What would your preference be, Mr. Chair? I can have someone answer some of those questions, or we can do what you like.
Mr. Chair, remind us again what the disposition of this bill is today. Recommended to go where?
The motion was to refer to the general register. However, I think there's some issues that need to be dealt with before that could occur, including the question. And I'm losing the in section 10 regarding enforcement. That,
yeah.
But Representative Beard, if you would like to hear testimony, certainly we can accommodate that.
But this is going to the general register, Mr. Chairman, please, for the sake of the state and the people that actually make this work. I think we should hear from some of them, and I don't know if they had notification that the bill was up or what, but please.
Of course, before we act on the bill, I would ask for testimony for or against the bill, but Representative Gardner, if you have someone that you think would be appropriate to call up at this time, let's do so.
I do, Mr. O'Gara.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ryan O'Gara. I represent Carl Bolander and Sons and FKB Environmental. So where I'm actually coming from both the contracting end of it with Bolander as well as the disposal end of it with FKB Environmental. Be happy to answer any questions. We, you know, as our companies do support this legislation, we think, you know, a lot more can be done on construction demolition waste recycling. The only concerns I have are more technical. Just I do want to kind of the situation you pointed out where, you know, sometimes, you know, the definition here is that of recycled or reuse, which is somewhat limited. Sometimes when you do crush concrete to use as fill at a job site, not sure it'd technically be recycling. Or if someday, and there's been a lot of talk about biomass and that, if we can get, you know, construction demolition debris wood as a, which is a biomass source, you know, waste energy isn't technically recycling or is it reuse, and you'd hope that, that those would be included maybe in the 40%. And furthermore, too, it's kind of, it's limited to recycling facilities, and some, a lot of times it's done with mobile concrete crushers where they don't necessarily have an MPCA recycling facility permit, and it, you know, hopefully we just have some language that would, or if at our landfill, if we were to set up a processing line, that technically we have a disposal facility permit and not a recycling facility permit. But we would hope that, you know, that won't be excluded from the, you know, the realm of places that the material could be delivered to. But I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee has.
Representative Sears.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for reading my mind. Yes. Lionel, what did you say your last name was?
O'Gara.
O'Gara?
O'Gara, yeah, I like the...
Okay. Like the I wanted to call you Mr. O'Gara. The bill talks about a 4,000 square foot requirement just in the metro area here. By the way, Mr. Gardner, I'll come back to the metro area in just a moment. The 4,000 square foot building is not a very large commercial type building or anything like that. There are a lot of people that do that, or are there just a few people that actually are into demoing buildings? Or are we going to be touching a lot of people right now that don't have the onus of many state permits and so on and so forth? Can you talk to us about that industry and who tears down a building that like that?
Mr. O'Gara.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and hopefully if I don't know if anyone from AGC is here representing more of the contractors at large that could speak more about the industry. 4,000 square feet would be at least, you know, in most cases, you know, more than just the average residential dwelling, so it would probably be more focused at commercial establishments. Not sure if that's what the answer you're getting at is.
Mr. Chairman, what I'm looking for here is that, you know, when there's an urban redevelopment issue or somebody tears down a part of a strip mall, it doesn't take too long to exceed 4,000 feet. And I think, again, the assertion is there's a lot of steel in there. Steel is very valuable, and there's nobody in their right mind is going to landfill steel. That just happens. So, again, I'm looking for the necessity of doing this, and I'm looking for the line 117. Contractors must maintain records for 3 years. Now we've got a new government requirement on some small business that comes in and tears down small strip malls, for instance. Maybe this is for Mr. Gardner. What is the penalty for non-compliance with that? Who designs the records? Where do we keep them? Who do we send them to? Do we just have to hold them and see if somebody at MPCA decides one day, I think I'll go check records? What are we thinking in that?
Representative Gardner. Mr. Chair and Representative Bearden, Mr. Chair, I have a suggestion for maybe the path of this bill that can help address some of these when I'm done with that. But generally, when you take a truckload of material to a transfer station, landfill, waste energy facility, or recycling center, you get a weight slip, which tells you the weight, and that's how you're charged for the volume. And those are essentially the records that you keep, just as you might keep receipts on, you know, your credit card, for example. Mm-hmm. So they're available for inspection. There are solid waste inspectors who have to do check on facilities to make sure they're being managed in a proper fashion. Mr. Chair, one other thing I was going to suggest, since in the last hour I had questions about the phone directories, and I was under the impression I didn't have an issue, and Representative Atkins at first said he didn't need to see it, I was going to maybe suggest that we can move this to Commerce as an added step to make sure that we get some of these issues addressed. And I wasn't really getting the feedback I was looking for on the SIP part, and I would be willing, just so we can work out the issues that seem to be of more contention, to delete the section that deals with SIP at this time.
That motion would be in order. Representative Gardner, can you tell us which section that would be? Are you referring to Section 9, Representative?
That's correct. I'd like to make an oral amendment to delete Section 9.
That's page 5.
Representative Gardner, we're just trying to sort out here the implications of the amendment. Trilo, can you help us sort this out? Adopted the amendment.
I think I would...
It has section 9 in it.
Renumbered 8, I guess.
I think I'd prefer... We've been adding and subtracting sections from this bill as it's gone through committee, and I think it might be more helpful to the advisor if we did this by page and line numbers. So I suggest a motion to delete on page 5, line 17 through 32. And on page 6, delete lines 1 through 3.
I would revise my motion to that, Mr. Sheriff. That's what should be done.
And just to be clear then, Mr. Eloff, what would be, we would still have a section 9, which would be reflected in the amendment?
There would be a section,
page,
right.
One of the amendments. Lines 22 through...
Well, this amendment also deleted the section 1 in It gets complicated, Mr. Chair, which is why I suggested the page and line numbers. There will be a section 9. I can't say right now what it will be.
So... Mr. Eloff, Representative Gardner, if we act on the deletion of those lines in the bill, it would not have any bearing on what we passed in the amendment. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Representative Gardner moves the deletion on page 5 of the bill. Lines 5.17 through 6.3. Everyone understand the amendment? Discussion to the amendment. Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Gardner. I appreciate your willingness to delete that section. My offer still stands to work something out, and actually having just spoken with the department informally about the existing programs that do meet the cost effectiveness test under SIP, there are some solid waste reduction programs and initiatives that the utilities are currently engaging in that I think you and I should perhaps sit down with staff and talk more about that and see if there's something that we can do a little bit more wisely. Just to caution, I think, for this committee, and I know that our next bill will also deal with this section of statute, that one of the things we want to be wary of is adding 126 subdivisions within the SIP statute for options, very, very few of which will actually meet the cost effectiveness test and will make the administrability of the program more difficult. So I appreciate very much your willingness to continue working on it, and I'll work hard with you to make it work, Representative Gardner. Thank you.
Thank you.
Further discussion to the amendment. seeing none, all those in favor of the Gardner amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? That amendment is adopted. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one further suggestion for Mr. Gardner at this point. Representative Gardner, you talked about starting it in the 7-county metro area instead of the whole state at once, so that kind of gives it a chance to work out all the problems and the bugs before you take this program statewide. May I generously offer that perhaps the excitement of instigating this should be tried outstate first and exempt the metro area so you get all the bugs and stuff worked out, and then if it's going okay, then you can bring it here. I'd be happy to make that amendment anytime you're ready for it. Mr. Chair, Representative Bird, 80 solid waste officers in those outstate counties who will give me a call tomorrow to tell me that's not something I should do, but I appreciate the suggestion.
Further discussion to the bill. Representative Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Gardner. Just to give us an idea as to what we're talking about with regard to volume of waste material, it's my understanding that demolition material is that impact is quite large compared to mixed municipal solid waste. Do you have any type of comparison as to what type of impact we're really...
Mr. Chair, Representative Osmond,
Representative Gardner.
Our waste stream is roughly half municipal, which is our garbage recycling kind of stuff, and the other half is C&D, construction waste, construction demolition debris, although it is not measured currently by the PCA in the way that cans, bottles, paper, and other waste is. And that's actually one issue that we've got. But they do have permits for all of those facilities that do accept material for landfilling as well as recycling. So they do have a general scope of how much material we're doing. But some of the material, like shingles, are being used in hot mix asphalt, for example. So there are markets for the material.
Representative Osmond? Mr. Chair, and I thank you for that, Representative Gardner. Just so people understand that as we have limited landfill space, this is, as we've been pushing for mixed municipal solid waste to do as much recycling as possible, it's equally important, I think more important at this point, to get something similar going on the demolition waste, because we're losing landfill space, and that's what you're going to have to do in the future. You will. I won't. You'll have to site more landfill. You'll find that to be a very fun job.
Representative Gardner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Osmond, I agree. In fact, we do not have to line the bottom of construction waste landfills, which is a whole other ball of wax. Mr. Chair, would it be in order for me to revise my motion?
I would, that before you do that, Representative Gardner, I think that Representative Wagenius has indicated a desire to see the bill in the Environment and Natural Resource Finance Division, so perhaps that would be the motion that would be in order. And I would also suggest that unless you want to particularly visit Representative Mullery's committee, that you consider before you have the bill heard in the Environment Division, that you think about whether you want to have a civil penalty in the bill.
Very good. Are you suggesting that we remove the civil penalty now, Mr. Chair?
I think you have time to consider what you want to do with that. I don't really want to leap into more things than might be necessary at this time. But I believe the motion that would be in order would be to recommend the bill to pass and be referred to the Environment and Natural Resource Finance Division. I guess actually we have to go back to finance to be re-referred to finance with the recommendation that it be re-referred to the Environment and Natural Resource Finance Division.
I would so move, Mr. Chair.
Representative Welty.
Representative Gardner, Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, I just want to say I think that your goal here in bringing forward the bill is is very noble, and but at this point in time, looking at the language and having quite a few questions just about how, you know, the administration for the contractors and for the waste management to be weighing out everything and keeping receipts and working out those details, working out the issue of the penalty, civil penalty or whatever it's going to be in this bill, and not having a clear answer to that right now, and some of the other questions that were raised, I probably will not support the motion to move this bill forward onto the other committee. I'd prefer to have those questions answered in this committee before I would take a vote on it, but hopefully you will answer those questions, you will come up with a good bill, and I can support it at a later date.
Representative Gardner, do you have anyone else that wishes to testify?
I could answer the questions that Representative Wolfe has, but I would seek your counsel in terms of time management here also.
Well, Representative Gardner, I think considering all the constraints we have and moving bills in this session, that What we should do at this time is ask if there are people present who wish to testify for or against the bill, and then we'll see if we can move it out of here. Is there anyone who wishes to testify? Hilden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nancy Hilden, and I'm, I guess, proof, real proof that there is, in fact, an association for everything. I'm here on behalf of the Yellow Pages Association, which represents about 90% of all the Yellow Pages that are published in U.S. and Canada. And I have off the press, hot off the press, a letter from the association's president, an appeal that Representative Gardner has seen, but I have not yet had time, but I'd like to submit it to you, Mr. Chair, a request to remove the provision in this bill dealing with the local option for the local telephone directory opt-in provision that does include the federal penalty provision as well. And what we're asking for is simply a year's reprieve, members. The association has been working with a national association, a national recycling organization, the Product Stewardship Institute, and Representative Gardner has very kindly been open to conversation, although this has come up very, very quickly. In Minnesota, there are three very large publishers, of which the largest is R.H. Donnelly with 200 employees in the state. 120 of those employees are union members in the Minneapolis and St. Paul area. And I think that the primary concerns with this provision right now being enacted are twofold. Number one, there's economics going on, kind of a global economics with this issue of the web public, web accessible information versus hard copy. And we know that from Yellow Pages research on their own industry that about half of all adults in the U.S. reference a Yellow Page directory once a week. So that economics is just that there are jobs that are associated with publishing these things, and how this is done is going to be very important with how we keep the industry stable as it continues to feel pressure from the web. And so the other piece of it, members, is just that the listing entities in these directories tend to be local, small, or mid-sized businesses that are local. And sometimes when you go out on that web, it's hard to find that local business, and it really is handier to go to the Yellow Page directory. We're not asking to not do this. That's what I want to be clear about. We're asking for 1 year to let the industry itself try to do and implement its own voluntary opt-in program so that it matches what they're doing across the rest of the country. And again, I want to thank Representative Gardner for his willingness and openness to talk with us about how to do this.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gardner.
I would just point out for the record that I have worked on the draft of this bill for the last 3 months and had what Iowa has called a study bill process where I've engaged the stakeholders from the very beginning to ask them to let me know where the areas of agreement and consensus are and where they are not. And the Yellow Pages Association has been aware of this for a very long time, and I found out about this letter about an hour and a half ago.
And
I am interested in working on this.
And absolutely, I think that the point is that this the version of this bill as laid out in House File 3540 is what we're trying to respond to. We have been responsive to the MPCA. We've been also responsive in past comments to you. And we do, again, want to very much say that we appreciate the willingness that you've shown to work with us.
Representative Wagenius.
Let's get to the fundamental issue here. It's not whether I opt in or opt out. It's what do I do with the pile of telephone books in my garage. And I think I'm probably like anybody else. We've had a system in the state that we used to have a system, and now we seem that we don't. What's your plan for taking back your telephone directories?
You know, that's a very good question, and I think that thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think that that may be something that, again, is worked on and with Representative Gardner to find a way to do that most effectively.
If I could follow.
Representative Wiggins.
However, I think this issue's been hanging around about 10 or 15 years. I mean, what's the time frame that you're thinking about? 10 or 15 years? Or?
I come with some contrition here. I think that the industry perhaps has not taken the statutes and read them and applied them. I think there's been some confusion about what the current statute has meant. And so there's nobody is coming to you and saying this shouldn't have been done differently or sooner. What we are coming to you and saying, though, is the message has been heard, and we're asking for a year to let the industry do it. These don't get printed but once a year or so. So if you let us try to do this as an industry rather than put this in place, we'd appreciate it, and that's all we're saying. We think that it'll keep the industry as stable as it possibly can.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative
Wiggins. I would just like to make one observation because I did work on this issue about 10 or 15 years ago, probably closer to 15. And that's exactly what we heard 15 years ago. So doesn't quite get us to where we need to be because 15 years is a long time and it's a lot of stuff for 15 years.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For either Ms. Hilden or Representative Gardner, in our city, we throw all of our phone books right in with the mixed paper waste. In fact, they have us put all our waste together because they do the sorting at the facility. One of the impressions coming from the printing industry that groundwood has a pretty good price and they just grind it up. Am I missing something here? When they go through the recycling stream, do we treat phone books differently than we treat paperback novels or the newspaper?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, in fact, the value of the material is often used for cellulose insulation.
Yes.
The issue of the recycling requirement, which is in another statute, is actually not in this bill. And that's not for consideration today, but it does have value. The issue has been one of waste reduction, and the Pollution Control Agency's Solid Waste Report identified as one consensus area to focus on for waste reduction, and that was on telephone records.
Well, Mr. Chair, that was just my question. I thought I just heard comments that somehow telephone books weren't fitting in somewhere, and I think they do, don't they? They go right through the normal recycling program that we already mandate and our cities pay for.
Mr. Chair, you're correct. They are part of the waste stream now, but the
not the waste stream, the recycling stream.
Right on.
Chairman, I'm sorry to interrupt.
Recycling stream, but. The material does have value, but the statute as it is on the books, which is not part of the bill, has not been complied with by most of the telephone directory publishers, and compliance has actually gone down for who's actually doing the recycling, and to be honest, that's another issue for another day. But I believe Representative Wiggins wrote the original bill in that area, if I'm not mistaken.
Representative Wiggins, Representative Beard, are you done?
I'm done for now, but I'm thoroughly confused because I understood that we just threw them in a recycle bin and our recycle process, waste management in this case, takes them out and points them in the right direction when it comes out of the recycling stream, but perhaps I'm mistaken.
Representative Wiggins.
Perhaps you could just refresh our memory or tell us, for those of us who may don't know, what is the current statutory requirement that's not being met?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wiggins, telephone directory publishers are required to take back their directories. It's become a little bit dated because now a lot of that material is picked up curbside for recycling, and that makes the current statute a little muddy, but I didn't care to tackle that this year because it is a little muddy. This is actually an effort to focus on people who just do not want a phone book to receive in the first place.
Ms. Hilden.
I would just underscore what Representative Gardner just said, and the fact is that as this whole issue of what is waste or what is recyclable material, that has changed over this past decade and a half, And I want to assure you, Representative Wagenius, that I wasn't here when you first started working on this, and I will certainly do my best to relay the message that this is a serious, and I believe it is a serious commitment on the part of this association that does represent the vast, vast majority of the Yellow Pages, that they are going to do a good job at an effective opt-in program so that we reduce what actually gets people's garages, as you have a stack, and probably a lot of us do have a stack of these that they want to deal with properly.
Representative Wester.
Well, Mr. Chair, I wonder what Representative Solberg would say, because the more books you print, the more jobs are created in his district, and, you know, it seems to me it's not a financial incentive for the phone book companies to print a bunch of extra books that people don't need or want, because I would think they're not free. So it seems to me to have... It's been brought to your attention, but it seems like the free market system would at least drive you to print a calculated amount that's close or identical to the number of people that need one. But remember, these are jobs that... If you're printing too many papers or too many books, Representative Solberg's district benefits, and every job, if you want to look at it this way, is creating a waste. And if we don't want any jobs in this country, we could just shut down all the waste, and we wouldn't have to worry about anything being made, because then you'd never have waste to deal with. So it seems to me that the companies already have a financial incentive not to overproduce, but if they do, that's good for northern Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would remind members that the PCA's original proposal in their solid waste policy report was not to print any books unless you specifically asked for it. And I purposely did not follow that for the reasons Representative Weston named, but I do believe in a free market, including consumer choice. And if a consumer doesn't want a book and they're still having one foisted on them, they should have an option to get off the list.
Representative Osmond. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try not to waste your time. The question that I have is, you said you wanted a year's delay. Is that a year in the enactment date, or are you asking for us not to even consider the language for a year?
Our preference would be to not consider the language for a year, only because then you come back with a year later with a language that's on the books that you have to then try to mesh with what's going on. So our preference would be to have this whole issue go away for a year with a commitment, and we have a letter in writing with that commitment from the association to actually implement voluntarily what this legislation is proposing to do. And again, these directories are not printed as frequently as a lot of things that are published in the state are printed, and so we think that it's a reasonable delay. A delayed effective date could work, but again, our preference and strong suggestion would be to let the industry try to continue to work at that national level and come up with something. And then come back to Representative Gardner and report in on how this is working and demonstrate to him, to his satisfaction, that what he wants to accomplish is being accomplished.
Well, I'm sure that all the members of the committee will be glad to learn that we do not have to vacate this room at 4 o'clock. So we are going to hear Representative Saylor's bill. And members, I would point out that I believe that the reason that this bill came to this committee in the first place is largely due to the now defunct former Section 9 or whatever it was. And I think that what we have been talking about for some time now are really matters that are more appropriately discussed in Representative Wagenius's committee. And since the motion is to move the bill there, I would suggest anyone that feels passionately about it that is not on Representative Wagenius' committee could just find out when the bill is going to be heard there, and perhaps it would be able to make your views expressed at that time. But I think at this time, unless someone has something really compelling to say, we would entertain Representative Gardner's motion to refer the bill to the Committee on Finance with the recommendation that it be re-referred to the Environmental Finance and or Environment and Natural Resources Finance Committee. Tim, did you have something?
Chairman Hilke, CWA represents the people that work for Donley. And
you need to identify yourself.
I'm sorry, Tim Levison with the CWA, Communication Workers of America, Minnesota State Council. And we represent the people that work at Donley Company that purchased it from the Carlisle Company, that purchased it from Quest. And that's the Dex Yellow Pages, and we represent roughly 100 or so people out there. This was just brought to my attention today, and I've been interested in listening what's going on. I see this as people probably receive probably three sets of Yellow Pages. The reason for that is divestiture and the law that was passed that CLEX can, be free carriers, or not free carriers, but wholesale carriers on the telephone lines. So what they do is they all sell advertising and Yellow Pages. And some companies, maybe they'll buy, depending on who they're with, if they're with the CLEX, they may be in the Yellow Book. If they're with Quest, their services may be with Yellow Pages Dex. So sometimes you look up a business, it's not in one book, it's in the other book. That's what's going on, is that's why there's so many books, and that's unfortunate. Now, if you make a law that says you can't deliver Yellow Page books unless somebody asks for them, or they have an opt-out, this is going to affect the business, and the business right now is taking a hit. I was just talking to one of our representatives today, and the take is down 30%. At Dex, the stock has gone down from $84 when it was moving pretty good down to $5. This is an industry that's in flux, and that I think you have to take a hard look at before you put any more hard stuff on them that will take away from their profit margins. That I think asking for a year for them to do this voluntary is something that I think is reasonable. From our standpoint, because we represent those workers, we don't want to have this industry come back and say, "In Minnesota, we can't do this anymore, so we're going to start moving our offices out of here." And that sometimes happens. And we would hope that we'd at least give them the benefit of the doubt for a year and hopefully work something out, so it wouldn't affect our workers that we represent. Thank you.
Representative Gardner, would you like to renew your motion?
I would, with an apology that this took so long, that Representative Hilton. Yes.
Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of the Gardner motion to refer the bill to Committee on Finance with the recommendation that it be referred to the Environment and Natural Resources Finance Division, please signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Gardner, if you have some work to do in the next few days.
I've been doing the work for 3 months, Mr. Chair. I'm waiting for other people to come up with plans.
Representative Saylor. Representative Taylor, you have a motion for us? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move my bill number 3857.
And Representative Taylor, you want to tell us about it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I do. Last year, we put into place a rather aggressive renewable energy standard and put a number of requirements on the utilities, one of which was to meet energy conservation guidelines. And one of the things that was noted that is not addressed or had not been addressed is the opportunity for solar thermal heating devices to be included as part of the consideration in the CIP, or the conservation improvement. And that's what this bill is about in particular. What it does is simply allows the solar thermal panels, that technology, to be considered. I have worked and met with members of the utilities and also with Department of Commerce, and I have another testifier here who will address a little bit more about what solar thermal panels are, what they can do, how they can save energy, and help us to meet some of the goals that we put in place last year. Furthermore, I had intended to have an amendment that came about with working with the Department of Commerce and some of the utilities. Due to the time strictures of this day, we were unable to get that put together. It's a little bit long to do as an oral amendment. So what I would like to do, with the permission of the chair, is present this bill, have the testimony, and then I would, if we could, lay it over till Wednesday, when I will have the amendment in hand, in case some of our testifiers are not able to return. Would that be satisfactory?
We can do that, Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At this time, I would like to turn the testimony over to one of the testifiers, and that is Carl Nelson with the Green Institute. He's had experience dealing with solar thermal panels and with the ways that they can save energy in residential and even in commercial applications. Thank you.
Mr. Nelson, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. A little bit about our experience with
Mr. Nelson. You do need to identify yourself for the record.
Oh, sorry, Carl Nelson, with Associate Director at Green Institute, and the Green Institute until recently had the largest solar electric array on our building in South Minneapolis. We have been surpassed in that, which is a good thing for the development of the industry. In regards to solar thermal, a lot of what I'm going to be speaking to came from a recent assessment that we did of some solar thermal installations that were done in South Minneapolis, and we did a report on that. Some of which is on the back of a fact sheet that I believe Mr. Pomeroy had made copies of. Here, some of the figures from that report, and I'm just going to go through a few of them. I'll be rather brief because I realize we're already longer than we had intended here. In regards to the specific bill, this would allow solar thermal to be considered an energy conservation device, and that that is appropriate, especially solar thermal as it reduces the energy demand, and it doesn't really go back on to the grid like a solar electric might do. It's totally self-contained within, you know, if it's at a house, it's totally self-contained within the house, so it acts very much like a conservation device, and this would allow it to be considered as such, while still preserving the cost-effectiveness test, which makes conservation the cheapest way to reduce fossil fuel carbon emissions. You know, a couple points that we discovered with writing the report is Minnesota. A lot of people think we're way up north here, and we don't have good solar resources. But actually, we have surprisingly good resources compared to Germany, for example, which has, on a per capita basis, about 10 times the amount of solar thermal insulation as the United States. We have much better solar resources than Germany does. And likewise, another factor that people don't think about with solar hot water is we have very cold water, especially during the winter, and in terms of providing something to heat, we actually have more water to heat than you do in more well-endowed states such as Arizona. So that means that for a two-panel system, which most houses would kind of fit into that category, you would actually save more energy in Minnesota with a solar hot water system than you would in Arizona with that same two-panel system. So I guess the point is that we are in an appropriate state for doing a solar thermal, and that it can make significant contributions to reducing our fossil fuel usage. Another thing about solar thermal is, unlike solar electric, there are jobs that are supported. In my town where I grew up across the lake is Starbucks, Minnesota, and they just opened a solar thermal manufacturing facility there. Most of the panels that they sell, Solar Skies is the name of the business, actually are going to Illinois and the Chicago market. And so this bill could help them in the long run to produce more of their panels for the local market. But expanding the market here in Minnesota does help manufacturing businesses here in Minnesota. Another thing we discovered is there's really a lot of consumer interest in solar thermal, and this responds to that as well. I think I'll just close off my comments there unless there are any other questions.
Representative
Weston. Mr. Chair, Mr. Nelson, a couple comments you made. One, why would we have better sun power or solar power here than Germany? But because they're closer to the North Pole, or, I mean, geographically, aren't we somewhat similar to them on the line of latitude?
Mr. Nelson.
What would be an explanation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, they have cloudier skies than we do here. There's many factors that go into how much sun you get, and one of them, as you mentioned, is the latitude. So in general, the closer you are to the equator, the more sun you're going to have. But another one is weather patterns, and the weather patterns are not as favorable. We have a lot more days of clear skies here in Minnesota than you know, say on the east coast of the United States, or than Germany.
Second, the water issue in Arizona. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't follow that. We've got more water here than Arizona, but why would we use more here than they do? Or I didn't quite follow how you were making that analogy.
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom. Yes, the answer to that question is that if you were to put the same system up, I think I can explain it this way. If you were to put the same system up in Arizona that had two hot water panels on the roof, and those panels are you know, able to produce heat 12 hours a day or 8 hours a day or whatever, however much sunlight there is, they're constantly able to produce heat. during the throughout the entire year. However, in Arizona, you may only have to raise the water temperature from, say, 60 degrees as it comes out of the groundwater to, the temperature that you take your shower at, say, at 80 degrees. So you're only raising that water temperature 20 degrees, and once you do that with the solar panel, the rest of the heat is wasted. If you can't use it at the house, you're wasting the capacity of that panel. Whereas in Minnesota, even in the summertime, that temperature differential, we're going to have much colder water. It's able to use the heat energy from those panels. Does that help to explain that?
Representative Saylor apparent delete all amendments has mysteriously appeared here, which seems to have quite a bit more substance to it than the original bill. Are you prepared to discuss this at this time?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am, and I would also ask some other testifiers to come forward that had worked with me on this particular amendment. This amendment basically addresses some of the concerns.
Let me ask first, the members have the amendment that is just voted HF 3857-Saylor. Apparently they do, yes. Go ahead, Representative Saylor.
Is this the delete out amendment?
I believe that is the author's intention. Yeah.
That is correct, Mr. Chairman and members.
Representative Sale, go ahead.
Thank you. Yes, in conversations with members of the utility companies in the past week or beyond, we actually had been trying to come up with that with language that would be acceptable to them, and it was just this morning, late morning, that I was given this information. If I could, at this point, have Assistant Deputy Commissioner Mike Bull speak to this and to some of the changes that he worked on as well.
Mr. Bull.
Mr. Chair, I'm Mike Bull.
Sooner or later, it would come to you.
with the Office of Energy Security. In conversations with Representative Saylor and working with our internal conservation advocates, some external conservation advocates outside the department and the utilities, I think that we've come to near to a consensus around how to move. We support Representative Saylor's bill, and we wanted to find a way to make this work within our conservation programs in a way that maintains the integrity of the SIP program. As I believe you've had a discussion here this afternoon, it was the previous bill. And so what we've tried to do is to work this into, there's an existing carve-out for renewable energy for SIP. It's in 216D2411, which is the section of law that follows the SIP statute itself. And it allows 5% of SIP expenditures to be used for conservation programs. And so what we've done is to work within that current SIP carve-out to more focus that section on these solar technologies in a way that both meets our conservation advocate needs and the utilities needs as they want to move these projects forward. And so that's the language that you have in front of you. And I worked on it over the weekend and brought it to Representative Saylor early this morning, and I appreciate her flexibility and willingness. And Representative Brainerd, just for your help, I'm working on yours as well. I think we're going to find a pathway on your solar carve-out as well.
Mr. Bull, considering that we began talking about solar thermal, could you explain why on the second page of the amendment in paragraph B, we have a definition of qualifying solar electric project.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, the there is actually a large contingent of folks that wanted to be able to do what we have talked about as micro renewable projects, single site projects that actually have the same effect. It reduces the effective load at that site of energy use at that site as a conservation improvement. And solar electric has that same effect as solar thermal. They have different cost effectiveness ratios, and so that's the challenge for these projects. But one of the important things is you'll see on the following section, this new section 3, subdivision 4, these projects all have to meet cost effectiveness tests for these projects. They all have to, they would count, if you'll recall that the energy savings goals that was set last year required a minimum 1%, a total of 1.5%. These projects would count potentially above that 1% so that we maintain the integrity of at least that 1% for all these types of projects. And one of the things, the importance to the utilities was that the opportunities potentially for if there are good projects and they install them, they get their opportunity for performance incentives, which is provided for under the current SIP law. So that's the structure of the proposal we brought for you in order to get the broadest acceptance among the people that we've been talking to.
Mr. Bull, there's some question even about solar electric in terms of how do you measure the output and how it should be counted, but how do you do that with solar thermal? There doesn't seem to be anything, there wasn't anything in the original bill, and there doesn't seem to be anything in the amendment either that makes clear how, if we're going to credit these installations against the SIP requirement, how do you measure what the output is?
Mr. Chair, measurement and verification is critical to maintaining the integrity of the SIP program. And I think that the way SIP works is that the utilities essentially make file plans with the office for review. Our technical staff review those plans and match those plans up against both the cost effectiveness test as well as the measurement and verification requirements that we see. And then we approve or disapprove those plans and work through that with the utility. So measurement and verification would be part of the proposal that we get from the utility and would be a requirement before a plan was approved.
And just in layman's terms, how do you measure the output of a solar thermal panel, and how does that equate to the measurements that we use for the SIP program?
Mr. Chair, I don't know. Mr. Chair, I know that there are people at the department that would be able to answer that question.
It's a good idea.
You've scratched completely the surface of my understanding of the SIP cost effectiveness.
I'm sure we recover from that. Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, in the order of my questions, the first is, Mr. Bull, do you know if the solar energy projects, whether thermal or electric, that are in the DE amendment have been part of the Dean Savings study that's been ongoing, and I think going to the chair's question. I can't remember. I don't believe that they have, but do you know if they've been considered part of that? Mr. Chair, just that may be one of the we have a process currently in the as a result of our last SIP change to establish standard deemed savings assumptions around the state, and that may actually be something that they could tackle as part of the next step in that process, because that's a concern that I have. My second question for
Mr. Bull, is the second sentence in the new section 3 on page 3, the cost effectiveness. The first part makes sense. The second part, the and other guidelines to be developed by order of the commissioner, if you could just help me understand what that means and why it's necessary, that would be helpful.
Mr. Bull.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, specifically what we were thinking about with that phrase is the installer requirements, the things that go beyond just the cost effectiveness. We want to make sure that these are being installed in the right way by people who are trained, so that we are able to maximize the benefit of the project, of the installation. So that specifically was what I had in mind.
Representative Kalin.
One last thing, Mr. Chair. Representative Taylor, I like the DE amendment a lot, and I like the way that you've worked this out. I think it makes perfect sense. Just for the committee to recognize that I think Mr. Bull just gave us another instance where we have green jobs opportunities of installers. We need to do some ramping up in our MinQ system to get more trained installers of these systems. But speaking with Honeywell and Johnson Controls about this House Bill 3669 that this committee addressed, I think it was last week, energy engineers is the term that they're using, but there are tons and tons of jobs out there where we need to really ramp up our technical training. I know the department is working towards that, and we appreciate your partnership, but we need to get more serious about it, and I think this committee gets it, and I hope that others do too.
Further discussion to the amendment? Representative Saylor, discussed the amendment as coded HF 3857-Saylor, but I think in order to make it clear that this is, in fact, a delete-all amendment, that we should delete Saylor and instead refer to it as the DE1 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I would certainly prefer that.
And Representative Saylor, if you wanted to move adoption of the HF 3857 DE1 amendment. Mr. Eloff, you had an observation?
Just some technical points, Mr. Chair. We should put at the top of the page there, delete everything after the enacting clause and insert colon to conform with the form of DE1 DE amendments. And also, right under that, put in section 1 next to Minnesota statute, section 216D.2411.
Excellent. And Senator Saylor will incorporate that into her amendment.
And on page 2, Mr. Chair, the last paragraph on that page, which defines qualifying solar thermal project, should be, I believe, paragraph E rather than paragraph C. And on the next page, the three definitions at beginning at the top should be labeled paragraph F, G, and H.
And Representative Taylor, would you like to incorporate those changes as well?
Mr. Chair and members, I would.
Further discussion to the amendment, Representative Weston.
Mr. Chair, Representative Taylor, but maybe Mr. Bull. Are you changing anything to make the, right now it's permissive language up to 5%, that's what you're referring to, where I believe, are you making any of this shall, or what under current statute otherwise prohibits solar from being part of this 5% expenditure?
Representative Taylor.
Mr. Chair and Representative Westrum, this is indeed permissive language. It is to the intent to open the door for solar technologies as they come on board. They are becoming increasingly more effective. And as mentioned earlier, we have manufacturers within the state and more that will be getting into this. But the intent of this piece of legislation is to make sure that we do indeed have a broad base of energy components that will count towards our energy conservation. And certainly recognizing that, first of all, the number one piece is to to energy conservation, but there is room for other aspects as well. But it is permissive language and is not telling anyone that they must use solar thermal panels or any other device.
What restricts the current language from allowing solar to be used as part of that expenditure?
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, I think you're right in pointing out that there isn't a restriction, but I think what this does add is it adds some criteria directed where the utilities will have a sense of what we'll be looking for as a department when they bring these projects forward about what we'll be looking for in order to approve them so we can get the projects out in the field. So I think it's important on that side. It's also important, I think, to let them know how we'll count them and also that these projects can qualify for the performance incentives potentially as that is developed, as those incentives are developed. So I think that's the value added of this specifying language.
Senator Weston.
Sure, I've got a couple more follow-ups. So, Mr. Bolt, to understand how you explained it, you're not going to let them count this towards their first 1%, but it could be counted over the 1%, up to 1.5%?
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, that's the intent. That's what we're looking for in order to ensure that at least the current 1% stays pure. Our conservation advocates within the department and external to the department as well are very aggressive about maintaining that those projects to fill that 1% really need to be what we have all considered to be energy conservation, energy efficiency projects. The way the SIP program is currently established, you have the 1% minimum standards up to 1.5%. That 0.5% is waivable by the commissioner in certain circumstances. And so what we would do is that we would put this in this 0.5% so that this would give utilities and others a place to go instead of asking for a waiver. They would have some additional things that they could do in that category.
So,
Representative Weston,
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bowe or Representative Saylor, how is this going to work? Who's going to pay this SIP amount of money? For solar thermal, I assume what you're replacing is either propane or fuel oil or gas or, in some cases, electric heat. Electric hot water heaters, potentially, I mean, how is this going to work? Is it mostly going to be the gas SIP that pays this? And anybody in rural Minnesota that doesn't have gas, there's no SIP on propane or heating oil. Can they still go to their utility company and say, I want to put a solar system in, put a program in of SIP that will let me put it in so I can heat my house with solar?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative
Mr. Ball.
That's a great question. The way we currently the SIP program operates, it has to be utility served services that you're reducing. Your energy savings has to come from the services you're receiving from your utility. So, in an instance where it's propane or oil heat, those would not qualify as a general rule. It would be a natural gas if you're on a natural gas line, or electric heat if you're being served by your utility. Those are the services that the energy that we're looking to save. These programs are paid for from utility assessments on their ratepayers for the benefit of their ratepayers.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Saylor, I support, and I was going to say wholeheartedly, but I reserve those words because I think we could make this better. I think you're going in the right direction. One, I think we should change may to shall and start using 5% of these funds to incubate and stimulate this. But I'm I also think we should probably make some of that first 1% eligible for these conservation-minded sources of electricity. If it's a small windmill or a solar system, I mean, once you have those in place, you're using emission-free fuels to make these replacements. And so I'm wondering why we don't allow it to be part of that 1%, or say they shall put 5%, because this is just permissive language. And as you know, the consumer out there, the biggest dilemma is how do they capitalize this this expenditure? And one way is to help if the utility company will offer a $300 or $1,000 rebate or something, but they still have to be able to capitalize this. And so I would like to see us even go further, and maybe that $6, if we make may to shall, you know, you could then also get creative with letting the utility set up some revolving low interest or zero interest loan program, so people can capitalize this and use the savings towards the ability to pay off those products. And so I'm wondering if you'd be open to working on anything like that between now and Wednesday.
Representative Taylor? Mr. Chair and Representative Westrom, it is certainly the intent of any of the STIP programs, the conservation, to look at our energy conservation efficiencies, first of all, and that is one piece that we have kept in mind. But it's my contention there will be more and more of these, as I think you are alluding to as well. There will be more businesses. This is kind of a jobs bill as well for those small businesses and not so small businesses in Minnesota that will be, that already are and will be continuing to build the solar thermal devices, which are, by the way, beyond just heating water, but they also do space heating of air, so that there is a greater capacity there. I would certainly be willing to take a look at that language, but I would want to make sure that, you know, that it fits in with the concerns that we have overall for energy conservation first, and this being opening a door to additional technology, which as time progresses will improve in its efficiencies as well. So, you know, I think we should look at this as we go along. Perhaps the place to start with this is permissive at this point, and certainly go beyond that as it becomes more available.
Mr. Chair.
Representative West.
Representative Saylor, and maybe Mr. Bull otherwise knows the answer to this, but of the 5% that's been permitted in law, how much of that, do we hit 5% a year? How much of that has been used for renewable energy projects? Do you know?
Mr. Bull.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, I don't know specifically. I do know that utilities use this provision quite a bit. But Minnesota Power and Great River Energy have solar energy. They match our state solar rebate program through this section. So it is being used. It's being used in a number of respects. It's an Initiative for Renewable Energy in the Environment is being funded through this, through 2411. There are a number of uses for this section, it is being used. I think that this will definitely help in terms of allowing it to be used for the solar, thermal and solar electric projects.
Representative Saylor, there's one other thing we're going to have to ask you to incorporate into your amendment, which is the effective date, which I presume you would just wish to pick up from line 23 of the original bill and add that to the amendment.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Eloff, would you like to comment on that?
Yes, it would be the last line on the DE amendment. Effective date, sections 1 to 3 are effective the day following final enactment.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Saylor incorporates that in the amendment. Members, we can continue the discussion if we so desire, but I think since we have not actually adopted the amendment, at this time, I think we have the amendment in the form that it needs to be, and Representative Saylor would move adoption of the HF 3857 DE1 amendment as amended, or as, you know, I guess as amended. All those in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Osmond, is it Bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I just have a question of Mr. Bull. This weekend in the Washington Post, there was an article about solar panels and their need for polysilicon, which is becoming very expensive, and it's jumped from $20 a kilogram up to $300 a kilogram. So over in China, they are now having a byproduct of silicon technochloride that is being improperly disposed of and causing some significant environmental damage over there. Is there a way that we are trying to protect our subsidies of this activity to where we're getting products that are not being developed through mismanagement and degradation of the environment, or have we not been able to get that accomplished?
Mr. Bull?
Mr. Chair, I wasn't aware of the Washington Post article, but I am aware that in general, just about any resource that we use has some issues that have to be dealt with. I don't know specifically about what is being done on with solar technologies in particular that are being employed today. I can tell you that there's a huge amount of resource being placed into research and developing those next generation solar technologies so it won't have these kinds of detrimental environmental impacts and actually increase the cost effectiveness of these technologies for customers. So I think that we do have a transition period where we're working on technologies, but I do see quite a bit of sunlight on the horizon.
Pardon my pun.
Mr. Chair and Representative Osmond.
Representative Saylor.
Thank you. I would just like to ask Carl Nelson to speak to that as well, because there's some differences within the technology between the solar thermal and the solar PV, which is the photovoltaic, which is what I believe Representative Osmond was referencing.
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, just a brief comment. The Washington Post article is about the solar electric, and solar thermal is not associated with those, with silicon production or anything like that. And I'm sure Representative Westrom would take you on a tour of the Solar Skies facility out on the way to his district. Sometime you could see exactly how they manufacture that, and it's a very, very clean process for the solar thermal. But yes, the imported materials do not always have the same standards right now anyway, outside of the U.S., that they do have the strict standards that are required of production facilities in the U.S.
Representative Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. I was more interested in making certain and getting confidence from Director Bull that they're keeping on top of this and watching, because what may not be a known problem today may be a problem tomorrow, and we need to keep up with it. So just need a little assurance.
Seeing no further discussion to the bill, I guess I should ask, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify for or against the bill? Seeing no one, Representative Saylor renews her motion that...
Were we going to pass it out today? I thought at the beginning they said we'd hold it over.
Well, Representative Westerman, the reason we're going to hold it over is because we didn't have the amendment prepared, but we have since dealt with the amendment. So there isn't any reason to hold it over at this point.
Mr. Chair, I hope to work with Representative Saylor along the way here then I would propose maybe we try to look at some ways to add a little more incentive or a directive that some of these dollars do in fact go to these projects, but I'll try to work with Representative Saylor for the next stop.
Representative Westrom, I think Representative Saylor is indicating that she would be willing to do that, but given the time constraints that we have in the press of business, I think we do need to move the bill out. So Representative Saylor then does renew her motion that House File 3857, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register. All those in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is passed through the General Register. Seeing no further business before the committee, the meeting is adjourned.